From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A busy week ahead at the United Nations. We begin with this press conference from the spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stéphane Dujarric, Monday in New York.
All right, good afternoon. The ECOSOC Forum on Financing for Development started today, bringing together representatives from governments, financial institutions, civil society, and the private sector. The four-day forum will pave the way for the high-level dialogue on financing for development that is scheduled for later this September. Speaking at the opening this morning, the Secretary General stressed that we do have the tools to tackle poverty, inequality, and climate change, but we need to act more boldly to face current challenges. He said that 2019 is a defining year for implementing the 2030 Agenda for the Sustainable Developments and the Paris Agreement, adding that financing is key to making this happen. Everyone, particularly developed countries, must meet their commitments in full, he said, referring to the Addis Ababa Action Agenda, which was adopted in 2015 by member states as a blueprint for financing sustainable development. At the global level, the Secretary General says he's convening a Global Investors for Sustainable Development Alliance, comprising of the chief executives of large companies around the world, while at the regional and country level, the UN is working to increase access to private and public finance for developing countries. Turning to Libya, the UN's political and humanitarian teams continue to operate in Tripoli, providing urgent humanitarian assistance to civilians and migrants and refugees impacted by the ongoing fighting. We have observed increased indiscriminate shelling in residential areas and attacks on civilian infrastructure, and again are reminding the parties of their obligations to follow international humanitarian law. In statements to the media over the weekend, the special representative for the Secretary General, Hassan Salameh, said that the conflict is severely impacting the lives and the living conditions of the Libyan people. Yesterday, Mr. Salameh and his deputy, Stephanie Williams, met in Tripoli with the president of the Presidency Council, Fayez Sarraj, and mayors from the western part of the country. Discussions focused on the necessity for an immediate halt to the fighting, protection of civilians, and provisions of humanitarian assistance to civilians in need. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports that thousands of civilians remain trapped in conflict-affected areas in the southern outskirts of Tripoli. Only a few hundred families have been able to be brought to safety so far due to ongoing clashes and reports of ambulance vehicles being deliberately targeted. Close to some 3,000 refugees and migrants remain trapped in detention centers in and close to conflict areas. In some cases, guards have abandoned the detention centers, leaving detainees to their own devices without basic life-sustaining supplies such as food or water. Humanitarian partners are continuing their efforts to access these highly vulnerable people and to provide assistance wherever access allows. So far, some 6,000 people have received some form of humanitarian assistance. According to the UN Migration Agency, the overall number of people displaced since the eruption of the conflict has reached well over 18,000. Some 48 civilian casualties have been registered, including 13 fatalities. These numbers reflect only those cases that could be individually verified and should be considered a minimum. The humanitarian community in Libya continues to operate on extremely low funding levels, just 6% of the requirements of the $202 million humanitarian response plan for 2019 have been met, according to OCHA. Turning to Syria, we welcome all efforts to find durable solutions for the people of Rukban in southeast Syria along the border with Jordan, in line with the results of the survey carried out by the UN and Syrian Arab Red Crescent in February, in which 95% of the people surveyed expressed a desire to leave but had expressed significant protection concerns. Yesterday, around 1,433 people, more than half of them were children, left Rukban. This is the fifth group of people who've left Rukban in the past 3 weeks. To date, more than 3,600 people have exited the camp for shelters in and around homes. Nearly 1,200 have left shelters to stay with relatives. The UN is providing limited support to the evacuees through the Red Crescent, including including food, nutrition, water hygiene kits, and medical services. The UN has not been granted access to the shelters, and we reiterate our willingness to engage more directly if granted full access to shelters in areas of origin and destination, and to displace people who are on their way to homes. Our humanitarian colleagues add that over the past 4 days, 10 people have been killed and 20 people have been injured in hostilities and explosions in Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama governorate in the northwest part of the country. We call again on all parties to the conflict to cease all violence and remind them of their obligation under international humanitarian and human rights law. Turning to Yemen, back here, Martin Griffiths, the special envoy for Yemen, briefed the Security Council by video this morning, and he announced that both parties have accepted the detailed redeployment plan prepared by General Lolesgaard for the first phase of the redeployment of Hudaydah. The UN is encouraged by this development. He said, "We now have to move with all speed towards resolving final outstanding issues related to phase two and the status of local forces." The special envoy said that while there have been some delay in implementation, it is important to acknowledge that the ceasefire in Hudaydah is generally holding and to see tangible progress in Hudaydah as we move forward towards convening a next round of political consultations. Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Locock, for his part, told council members that while the ceasefire in Hodeid has largely held, we've seen a pronounced escalation of violence in other parts of the country. So far in 2019, he added, nearly 200,000 suspected cases of cholera have been reported, which is almost three times as many as the same period last year. About a quarter of cases are children under five. Mr. Locock said humanitarian access problems remains, movements and customs clearances are withheld, visas denied, project agreements sidetracked and delayed, and many missions are delayed at checkpoints. Virginia Gamba, the Special Representative of Secretary General for Children Armed Conflict, told council members that more than 7,000 children were killed and maimed in Yemen between 2013 and 2018, while more than 3,000 were recruited for armed service. And yesterday marked 1 month since Cyclone Idai made landfall in southern Africa. In Mozambique, our humanitarian colleagues said 1.85 million people were affected by the tropical cyclone. Nearly 1.1 million people have received food assistance, and more than 900,000 have been reached with water, and over 155,000 with hygiene support, and some 18,000 with sanitation support. In Malawi, nearly 870,000 people have been affected. Over 10,000 households out of 110,000 households have been reached with shelter assistance. That's about 10% of all households requiring sheltering assistance. In addition, 40,000 households have received seeds and tools. Meanwhile, in Zimbabwe, 299 deaths have been reported, and the livelihoods of over 270,000 people have been impacted. So far, humanitarian partners have assisted an estimated 30,000 people in the worst affected areas with food. A supplementary feeding program is currently underway, targeting 70,000 vulnerable people. The revised humanitarian response plan, which calls for $337 million, including $282 million for Cyclone Idai, remains just 22% funded. And lastly, we say thank you very much to Jamaica for paying its budget dues in full, bringing us up to 84. Valeria.
Thank you, Stefan. On Libya, today the UN envoy Ghassan Salamé accused General Haftar of a coup attempt. This is the first time that UNR says something like that. Is this an anticipation of his resignation from the post, or is it an implicit admission of having underestimated General Haftar?
I haven't seen that particular quote, so I couldn't comment on it. I think our appeal is for all the parties to immediately cease the fighting, to create at least a humanitarian pause, for us to help the people in Tripoli. I mean, as you heard, we're having great challenges in reaching people. We've seen the targeting of ambulances, of medical personnel, which is completely unacceptable. And we need all the parties to recommit themselves to a political solution. Yep.
Follow up on Libya, Steph. Ghassan Salamé on the BBC this morning said that his greatest fear was that this would turn into a proxy war. Is this a concern of the Secretary General as well?
Well, our concern is that the conflict that we are seeing does not escalate out of control. It is clear to all that there are parties in Libya, and then there are parties outside of Libya who have influence on those doing the fighting. It is important that all the parties on the outside bring pressure to bear on their Libyan partners to ensure that the fighting stops. Yes, Stefano.
Follow up on Libya with two questions. One is about the government in Tripoli just say that there is the risk of 800,000 migrants, refugees, at this point they probably be considered refugees, leaving Libya. If what the UN consider people leaving Libya in this moment, are they refugees or migrants? And if they are refugee, can Italy keep its port closed like Look, has
the,
it
the,
now?
The designation that people have is granted after examination of files. So I'm not going to predict what people are. What is clear is that those third country, those nationals of other countries who find themselves in Libya, who've been trying to make their way to Europe, are at great risk of the current fighting. What is clear, as the Secretary General has repeatedly said, is that Libya is not a safe port of disembarkation for human beings, whether they're migrants or whether they're refugees. There is a body of international law regarding refugees. There is a global compact on migration. I think it is important that the rights of people be respected and that the dignity of every human being be respected.
And I have another question. It's about the Security Council, what the Secretary General thinks. The Security Council in this crisis has been saying for days now that he's united on the UN position, cannot be resolved in the military way. Usually when the Security Council is united, has a way to pressure who instead using a military confrontation. And we know how. And in the past, the Secretary General, when he saw that the Security Council united, for example, I'm thinking a Burma situation, is different in a sense, but at the same time, the Security Council acted united right away. So is the Secretary General taking advantage of this declaration that the Security Council is united, or is united only at words, but in reality is not united at all?
I will leave the analysis of the Security Council words and action to you. What is clear is that the Secretary General and his envoy are working based on Security Council resolution, Security Council mandates. We're not freelancing in any way. We are implementing the resolutions and the goals set forth by the Security Council. Carol, and then Evelyn, sorry.
Stefan, on the weekend on Cyprus, there were reports that the envoy, Jane Hall-Lute, has come forward with some proposals for restarting talks. Do you have anything on that?
There will be a report of the Secretary General on his good offices work that will be going to the Security Council this week. Evelyn, and then we'll come back to this hemisphere.
Yes, further on migrants, could you elaborate what's happened to them? The guards have abandoned the centers. Does that mean the migrants are locked in and the UN can't reach them?
Well, we are having very difficult time reaching those centers. The reports that we're getting is that the guards and whoever was managing some of those facilities have abandoned their posts, which means that these people who are already living in very difficult conditions are not getting the food and the water that they require.
And in Rukba and in Syria, who's preventing the access?
Well, as you know, we've had the UN has had difficulty getting the access and all the permissions we need from various parties to access Rukban. Madame.
Thank you, Stefan. Michelle Bachelet announced last week that she will be traveling to Venezuela shortly. Mm-hmm. She hasn't set a date, but also she said that it will depend on the opinion of the Secretary General for her to be able to travel. Do you have any information about that?
No, I mean, the Secretary General very much supports the work of the High Commissioner and her efforts in and around Venezuela as well. She has a mandate to fulfill, and we support her in doing so.
Also on Monday, Mark Lowcock, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator for Yemen, addressed the Security Council about the situation there.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. While the ceasefire in Hodeidah has, as Martin's just said, largely held, we have, as he's also indicated, seen a pronounced escalation of violence in other parts of the country. In Hajja, just north of Hodeidah, conflict has intensified in several areas. Fierce fighting in Kushar district displaced up to 50,000 people in February and March and was marked by continuous reports of shelling and airstrikes, causing scores of civilian casualties. In the Bani Hassan area of Abs district, over the last 2 weeks, fighting has forced nearly 100,000 more people from their homes. About half have fled to other areas in Abs, which is an extremely poor and water-scarce district, and now hosts upwards of 300,000 displaced people. The active front lines are now just a few kilometres from Abs district's main water source, which serves about 200,000 people. If fighting damages or cuts off this facility, we could very quickly see a major catastrophe. If fighting moves south to the Hodeidah border, up to 400,000 more people could be displaced. In Taiz, fierce fighting in March among different factions in a government-controlled area resulted in numerous casualties. Conflict has also intensified on established front lines in Al-Dale and along the northern border in Sada and Al-Jaf, displacing thousands more families. On 26 March, an airstrike in Sada landed close to a hospital supported by Save the Children, killing 8 civilians, including 5 children. On 2 April, armed men broke into a hospital supported by Médecins Sans Frontières in Aden. They kidnapped a patient and killed him outside the hospital. On 3 April, 3 women were reportedly killed and 2 children injured by an artillery shell landing near a school in Hodeidah. On 7 April, large explosions at a warehouse in Sana'a killed 14 children attending school nearby. 16 more were critically injured. Most of them were not even 9 years old. As the international community continues to support the Stockholm Agreement, it is critical that we do not lose sight of escalating violence elsewhere. In my briefing to you on 14 December, I called for a cessation of hostilities across Yemen. I am reiterating that call today. All the men with the guns and the bombs need to stop the violence. We again remind the parties that international humanitarian law binds them in all locations and at all times. Mr. President, humanitarian agencies are also confronting an alarming resurgence in the cholera epidemic, which we had successfully rolled back last year. After 2 years and more than 1.5 million suspected cases, cholera has affected nearly every Yemeni family in some way. 2 weeks ago, Dr. Mohammed Abdul Mughni, a highly respected pediatrician treating cholera patients at a public hospital in Sana'a, himself died of the disease. He had just described the outbreak as disastrous, telling journalists that, quote, "We are working to the extremes of our strength," end quote. So far in 2019, nearly 200,000 suspected cases of cholera have been reported. That's almost 3 times as many as in the same period last year. About a quarter of the cases are children under 5. This spike has come months before the usual increase during the main rainy season in August. And that means that current trends, if they're not brought under control, could quickly result in mass morbidity and death. Early rains are partly responsible, but the major drivers remain forced displacement and conflict-induced collapse of public infrastructure, including the country's water and sanitation systems, and the public institutions that provide basic services. You've seen the consequences of the destruction of the health system elsewhere too. More than 3,300 cases of diphtheria have been reported since 2018, the first outbreak in Yemen since 1982. Earlier this year, new measles cases surged to nearly twice the levels reported at the same time in 2018, itself a record-breaking year. As Martin's just reminded you, about 2 million school-aged children remain out of school. Some 2,000 schools are unusable because they've been damaged or they're hosting displaced people or they've been occupied by armed groups. Overshadowing everything is the continuing and very real risk of famine. In the past 4 years, millions of families in Yemen have been reduced to paupers. They have little or no income, even as the prices of basic commodities they need to survive increase relentlessly. Mr. President, humanitarian agencies are doing everything we can to save lives and protect people across the country. Last year, we reached an average of 8 million people a month, making Yemen the world's largest aid operation. This year, we're doing more. So far, the World Food Programme has delivered emergency food assistance to more than 9 million people every month. They intend to increase this to 12 million people in the coming months. Thousands of humanitarian personnel are staffing some 1,500 cholera treatment facilities in 147 districts across the country. Emergency response teams are treating patients, distributing hygiene kits, chlorinating water sources, sponsoring cleanup campaigns, and educating the public. They are, as Dr. Mugni said, working tirelessly. Humanitarian agencies have, Mr. President, kept millions of people alive so far. But we still face two major challenges. The first is access. We still encounter far too many restrictions on humanitarian action. The Red Sea mills in Hodeidah, which we've talked to you about before, are a compelling example. The mills contain enough grain to feed 3.7 million people for a month, and they became inaccessible in September last year as coalition forces advanced into the city. Ever since then, we've faced serious challenges in accessing the mills, which Martin and I both addressed in public statements in February. A UN team was able to conduct a one-day visit, finally, on 26 February. That mission allowed us to establish that most of the grain could still be salvaged if it's immediately fumigated. Efforts have repeatedly been made since then to cross the front lines to bring in workers to do the fumigation and to start milling the grain, a process that would take several weeks. We continue to work with all the parties to find the safest, most efficient way to get this food to millions of desperately hungry people who need it as soon as possible. The litany of other problems we've reported to you on access continue. Movement and customs clearances are withheld, visas are denied, project agreements are sidetracked, and missions are delayed at checkpoints. Most of the restrictions we're currently facing are imposed by Ansar Allah-affiliated authorities in the north. We appreciate their recent decision to grant additional visas, and we hope this will lead to further improvements in the access situation. In government-controlled areas, we also continue to engage the coalition on requirements introduced last December at Dubab checkpoint, which have caused delays for agencies seeking to deliver aid in government-controlled areas along the West Coast. Commercial food imports through Hodeidah and Salif in the first quarter of the year were about 40% lower than the previous quarter, and average food prices were more than twice the pre-crisis level. Commercial fuel imports are only 30% of estimated requirements. Correspondingly, fuel prices have nearly quadrupled in some places in the past several weeks. People are waiting for days to secure the very limited supplies of fuel which are available. With huge numbers of desperately poor, hungry families being priced out of local food markets, decision makers on all sides need urgently to find ways to speed up the berthing of ships in Hodeidah, to ease credit requirements, and to facilitate in-country shipments of fuel. As I discussed with the new governor of the central bank 2 days ago, we also need to see the exchange rate stabilised at a level which, as Martin has alluded to, makes it affordable for ordinary people to buy food. Mr. President, we are also increasingly concerned about the Safer Oil Tanker, a floating storage and offloading facility about 8 kilometres off the coast of Ras Issa Terminal in the Red Sea. Used to store and export oil since 1998, the tanker currently has about 1.1 million barrels of oil on board. It's in poor condition and has had no maintenance since 2015. Without maintenance, we fear that it will rupture or even explode, unleashing an environmental disaster in one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. We've been working with all parties to address this risk, supported by funding from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, starting with a technical assessment. Final approvals for the assessment have been pending since September. We hope that recent indications that a UN project will soon be able to begin work on this critical issue prove correct. Mr. President, the second potentially insuperable challenge we face is funding. In February, donors pledged $2.6 billion for humanitarian action in Yemen this year, including a further $1 billion joint pledge for the United Nations by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Last year's contribution from these two donors was channeled through the United Nations as a single unearmarked grant early in the year, which I consider a best practice in humanitarian donorship. That was also a major factor in enabling us last year to stem the cholera outbreak, to enable us to roll back food insecurity in half of the pre-famine districts, and to help us save more children suffering from complicated, severe acute malnutrition, more children than we were able to save in any other operation comparable globally. So while we were encouraged by the pledges made in Geneva, I need to tell you that nearly 4 months into the year, the UN Yemen response plan has actually received in cash only $267 million. This is about 10% of what was pledged and 6% of requirements. And it is 80% less than what we had received in cash at this time last year. Mr. President, UN agencies are rapidly running out of money for essential relief activities. The World Health Organization projects that 60% of diarrhea treatment centers, the central approach we have to tackling the cholera outbreak, could close in the coming weeks, and services at 50% of secondary care facilities could be disrupted. The World Food Programme reports that its pipeline for food vouchers and the in-kind food pipeline will break in June unless they immediately receive new money.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.